Well, hello everyone, and thank you for downloading this important audio program on estate planning. My name is Jeffrey J. Bureau. I'm a certified estate planner located in Scottsdale, Arizona. I've been practicing in the estate planning industry since 1982. Again, I appreciate you downloading this audio program. I feel it's an important step to understanding estate planning and putting your own house in order. During this audio program, we're going to break our discussion into three important sections. And we have estate planning attorney Thomas Lavelle with us, who will be answering a lot of very important questions for you. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
Good. Good, good. This is going to be a very valuable program because what we'll discuss is exactly the kind of conversation you should have with an estate planning professional the first time you meet. We'll help you get a head start on understanding how all this works so you can begin the process of putting a plan in place that protects your money and your family. Estate planning can be a little confusing, and I believe the reason why so many people procrastinate is because, number one, they don't know the right questions to ask. Number two, they don't know what the documents mean. Number three, they don't know whom to trust to help them. And of course, cost usually scares them away. Today, we're going to address all those concerns. So you understand how this program will go, folks. Let me explain what we'll be discussing so that you can stick with us throughout this entire program. This is a rather longer program, so please stick through it to the end. I found that the length is necessary to take a rather complex topic and make it understandable for you. In our first section of three, after I've introduced our estate planning attorney, Thomas Lavelle, we're going to discuss exactly what estate planning means in the state of Arizona and how the documents are designed to protect your family. I've been working in the estate planning business since 1982. I know exactly what questions you have. But to be thorough, we did a very extensive survey where we asked 2,500 people online what their concerns were, and we developed an exhaustive research report that helped us build the outline for this program. So we're going to be using that information to outline the most important questions you have, and during the first section, we're going to talk in layman's terms so you can quickly understand the difference between a will, a living will, a power of attorney, and a living trust. In the second section of three, we'll explain how living trusts work and why you may want to consider this as your estate planning choice. I know there's a lot of confusion about living trusts, which have been marketed heavily. First, I don't believe everyone needs a living trust, but far too many people are persuaded not to establish one when I think they should have set them up. We're going to explain in section two what a living trust is, how it's different from a will, how it avoids probate, how to transfer assets into a probate, why it can help reduce conflict with children, and more importantly, how it can save you a lot of money by not paying unnecessary legal bills. I have a family too. Even though I am in the estate planning business, I do not want the government or an attorney to be an extra beneficiary of my estate, and I doubt you do either. So we're going to talk about how a living trust may be a great option for you. Then in section three, the final section, we're going to talk about what I think is the most important discussion of the day, and that is how to find the right professional help in our wonderful state of Arizona. Not everyone who claims to know estate planning is qualified to write your estate plan. In this section, we'll outline how to find the right help and what questions you should ask. We have a very packed program, so please make sure that you listen all the way through to the end. The answers we get from estate planning Thomas Lavelle will shed great light for you on this subject. Before I jump into section one, I think it's important to give you a brief background about myself and explain why I'm qualified to host this program today. First, I hold the professional certified estate planner, certified college planning specialist, and registered financial consultant designations. I'm the president of Family Wealth Advisors, which is a wealth management and estate planning firm in Scottsdale, Arizona, right next to Scottsdale Fashion Square Mall in that area. I've been practicing since 1982. That's a long time to encounter. most all your questions and concerns, and I probably have a viable answer for you. And I've helped over 5,000 families in my career to wisely invest and protect their assets. Ever since 1985, I've always been listed each year in the Arizona's Who's Who of the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. And most importantly, I've been specializing in estate planning since receiving my certified estate planning certificate in 2002. To ensure a power-packed program today, I have with me estate planning attorney and friend Thomas Lavelle. Mr. Lavelle earned his Bachelor's of Arts degree in History and Economics from the University of Florida, where he was an undergraduate scholar. After working for the Palm Beach County Public Defender's Office as a felony criminal investigator for 2 years, he then graduated from Arizona State University School of Law and was admitted to practice in Arizona in 2001. Mr. Lavelle is a member of the Probate and Trust section of the Arizona State Bar and was admitted to the United States District Court, 9th Circuit, in 2001. Tom has focused in estate planning for over 10 years and has been involved in over thousands of estate plans. He has also settled or handled the probate for dozens and dozens of estates. We're excited to talk to you about this subject today because we are very passionate about what we do. We love helping people, especially with estate planning needs, because far too many people procrastinate and end up dying without any type of a plan. A recent survey reported that almost 70% of Americans die without a will, and that can be a devastating to a family. Without a properly developed estate plan, your family could get stuck in an expensive and long-lasting probate process, fight unnecessarily because nothing is spelled out, pay unnecessary taxes to the government, and pay a lot of money to an attorney to figure it all out. I've seen this, unfortunately, time and time again. I don't want you to experience this. That's why I developed this program, because I feel strongly about educating people in my community. I feel that the better you know the facts, the better you'll be able to make better decisions. So, folks, let's get started. The first section, and Tom, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Tom, a few questions for you that I know people are wanting to know, and that is the basics of estate planning. Tell me, why is estate planning important to even think about?
Well, I mean, there's several different reasons. You know, I think one of the important things with estate planning, in particular while you're alive, is that it goes ahead and allows you to make contingency plans while you are still alive, if you ever became incapacitated. And it does allow you to go ahead and know that things will be taken care of, and generally that can be accomplished without court being involved. Most folks do want to stay out of court, and there's good reason for that. Second thing it does is, you know, upon your passing, it allows you to dictate how your assets are to be cared for and taken care of and distributed. And so I think in the overall idea behind estate planning is that it just gives you peace of mind. It really, you know, it's one less thing you've got to worry about. It's a big thing that everybody is going to face at some point in time, but that peace of mind is priceless.
Well, when someone thinks about estate planning, what does estate planning mean?
Well, estate planning, as far as from an attorney's perspective, is basically people, a client, a married couple, a single person, what have you, going ahead and determining what's going to happen to their assets both during their lifetime and when they've passed. And then it determines the most orderly fashion to distribute those assets and upon your passing, but it also, you sit and you determine, okay, if something happens to me, who's going to take care of my assets, and also who's going to take care of my physical well-being as far as, you know, medical needs and things of that nature. So it's an overarching thing. It's really estate planning is planning your life.
Okay. And is it any different? I mean, I know you do the drafting and do the, you know, everything that way, but from the customer's standpoint, from your client's standpoint, is estate planning any different for them?
Well, not really. I mean, everybody does have their own goals and own needs and own wishes. So each person, you know, has a different idea of what it means to plan for their own life and own well-being. You know, some people, it's very important to make sure that something, for example, is set up for a grandchild. Other folks just basically want to avoid the issues of probate. Other people want to make sure that, you know, if they did become ill, that, you know, they've already got a contingency plan in place. So it, for each person, it does mean a little bit different, but all of those factors are generally touched upon for everybody.
Well, within the estate planning, what types of goals should the people listening, what should they have with their estate plan? What type of goals?
Well, they're certainly going to want to go ahead and make sure that they've thought about, you know, certainly what's going to happen to their assets upon their passing and how they would like things to be administered and you know, who they would like to and trust to take care of those things. But, you know, also kind of have an idea of who would you trust to take care of things for you while you're still here. You know, there's two components to the estate planning part there where you determine, okay, this is what's going to happen during my life, this is what's going to happen upon my passing, and making sure that within that estate plan, coordinating with investment professionals such as yourself in order to ensure that you have enough assets and a plan in place to live out your days and to know that you have the assets and the ability to care for yourself and then have a very good idea that I've also now potentially provided for you know, people, children, charities, churches, what have you down the line.
Okay. Is it easy to update? Does it avoid probate?
Depending on what type of estate plan you do, for example, if you have a what's known as a living trust or revocable trust or family trust, it's all the same thing. You basically you're able to amend or change your provisions anytime you want to. You're able to put things into the trust, take things out of the trust at will. You can convert the form an asset takes in the trust. For example, you could turn. You could sell a piece of property, turn that into cash, turn that cash into an RV, sell the RV, turn that into a van. It doesn't really matter. There's really no restrictions on anyone, and they are quite easy to change. They're built that way. It's sort of the type of folders that attorneys use a lot are what are called Redwells. They're sort of an expandable folder. So your trust, your living trust, would be the same type of concept. There, it will expand out or contract in as needed and as you direct it to do so.
Does it avoid probate?
Generally speaking, trusts will avoid the probate process. The idea behind having a trust is that you're, in essence, going to take your assets, title them into this entity known as the trust. That trust then owns and controls your assets. But you and or your spouse own and control that trust. So by extension, you still own and control those assets. The big advantage, one of the big advantages of doing a trust is that when you pass away, the trust itself doesn't has no effect on the trust. The trust sort of gets locked up, but as far as its day-to-day operations, it'll still keep moving right along. It just plugs a new person into the driver's seat, as it were. So assets that are in a living trust do not go through the probate process. Probate only is going to, as far as just your typical idea of the probate process, it only deals with assets that are in your own name when you pass away. So the probate process is to go ahead and make sure that those assets get out of your name and then ultimately end up where you wanted them to go, or if you don't make a decision about where they go, where the default in the law tells you where it's going to go.
How can it reduce or eliminate estate taxes?
Well, with a married trust, so husband and wife trust, the idea behind that is that it'll basically allow you to double up on the estate tax limitation exemption. Currently, it's $5 million per person, which at least up till now, it's certainly subject to change in the next year or so. But assuming it's $5 million per person, what happens with a married couple is they can have up to $10 million estate without having to pay estate taxes, because what would happen is husband and wife own together the $10 million estate. One spouse would pass away, and you would use that deceased spouse's estate tax exemption, lock that in, and then you would have $5 million cleaned or washed for estate tax purposes, and then the surviving spouse would have the other part of the estate, and when they pass, they're really only going to be looking at that other $5 million as a potential estate tax. So you are able to take each person's full estate tax exemption in a given year.
When the children take over, mom and dad or have passed on, is it, by having a trust, is it easier or harder for them to settle the estate?
It's generally easier, because what basically happens, if you think of a trust as sort of a company in a sense, the husband and wife are the president, as it were, of the company. If something happens to them, then it drops down to the next person or persons. That may be a child, it may be a friend or family member, and they basically just step into the slot. So it makes it easier in the sense that they're just plugged into the slot, and then what you have inside of the trust itself is directives as to, this is what I want done. And so there's a specific thing to follow for the what are called successor trustees. They're told to take care of the debts and expenses of the estate. They're then told to distribute, after that's done, to distribute any gifts of cash to charities. They're then told to distribute any particular keepsakes to anyone that you may have designated. And then after that, they're told to dispose of the remainder of the estate, how you have delineated it in the trust itself. So it's just an idea that you just follow the process and just do what is written down.
By having a trust, does it help minimize the legal bills or potential legal bills, or does it make
certainly, yeah, yes, it does. It's the idea that the estate plan itself, once it is put in place and the trust itself is in place, for example, and then is what's called funded, that just means that assets are then put into the trust. Once that's all done, that's pretty much all that there is to it. Then the trust moves and does what it's supposed to do. When the husband and wife have both passed, then it distributes out, and that will generally be without court intervention. That's one of the primary benefits of a trust, is that it is a vehicle that is designed to avoid the probate process, so then you don't have those legal bills. Attorneys will generally charge different, for example, hourly rates to work on a probate, or they may charge a flat fee of several thousand dollars to work on a probate, or they may charge a percentage of the value of the estate as a fee for probate. And
what's the common fees that you've seen that way?
Common fees, as far as percentage goes, anywhere from 3 to 8% of the estate value. Now, generally speaking, the larger the estate, the smaller the percentage that's taken. So, for example, on a $100,000 estate, they would probably charge around the 8% rate, which would be $8,000. But on a $1 million estate, perhaps they would only charge 3%. But that's $30,000. So
that's still a lot.
It can be quite expensive. And I've seen in other states, I've seen an attorney that did pretty much the only thing that this family had was a farm, and so they were land rich and cash poor. The farm itself was valued at around $800,000, and he charged 3% to basically do a deed and transfer the property out, and that was $24,000.
And folks, that's what we're trying to not have done to you, so thank you again for listening to this program. Now, Tom, within a estate plan, there are some basic documents that the people listening should consider. What are those documents, and would you define or explain what the documents are or what they do?
Sure. Well, the primary thing, and this is pretty much for anyone out there, regardless of if they need a complicated plan or not, but pretty much everyone on this earth, or at least in the United States, needs a couple of different documents that I would recommend you have, no matter what, regardless how much money you have or don't have. That would be a power of attorney for finances, power of attorney for medical needs, and then also what's known as a living will. Those are the most basic items in an estate, any type of, if you want to call it an estate plan, that everyone should have. A power of attorney for finances is a document by which you say, in the event I am incapacitated or otherwise cannot do things for myself as regards to my finances, I would appoint this person or these persons to do so. They would then access your accounts, your finances, and administer them for your benefit during your lifetime. Medical power of attorney is pretty self-explanatory in that you say, if I can't make medical decisions, I'd like this person to do so. And along with that, in Arizona, we do what's called a mental health care power of attorney. Since the legislature keeps changing the laws, we have to keep updating and in essence drafting more documents. And the mental health care power of attorney is in the event you do have a psychotic break, but also what we see it really honestly used more for is in the event of senile dementia or Alzheimer's, a mental health care power of attorney is necessary in certain facilities, and a medical health care power of attorney will not work in those facilities. Lastly, the living will is also what's known as a physician's directive, and in essence indicates your desire that if you have an incurable disease, injury, or illness that is in essence certified terminal by two doctors, that you don't want to be plugged into machines and in essence just existing. So if it's your way of saying, look, if the only reason I'm existing is because I'm plugged into the wall, I quit. You know, that's a very important document for a lot of folks to have. And one of the most famous examples I can think of is a young lady named Terry Schiavo in the state of Florida that was highly publicized because there was a big fight between what her husband said she wanted to do and what her parents said she wanted to do. So this is a document that eliminates that confusion and that those types of fights. But in other estate plans, you know, you have the idea generally of most folks would have an idea, well, I'll just need a will. And a will is a legal document that someone would eventually present to a court, and they would say, Judge, this document says that this is what this deceased person wants done with his or her assets. They want me to handle it, and so I would like you to sign off and allow me to have the legal authority to take care of this deceased person's assets. And so after the probate's filed and the process has begun, generally the court ideally would sign off and allow a person to go ahead and administer the estate, gather the assets, and divide them in accordance with someone's wishes. Next step up, I guess you could say, from that would be the living trust. It's a way that someone's making a contract with themselves, or they and their spouse are making contracts with themselves, whereby you say, okay, I would like to transfer all of my or our assets into this entity known as a living trust, and we agree that it will be administered by us initially, and then we agree that it will be administered by this person or this group or this company later if we cannot do so. Sort of way I like to think about a living trust is it's like an imaginary box or an imaginary filing cabinet into which you put your assets. Then those assets are put in there nice, neat, and organized, administered by you or on your behalf during your lifetime, and when you pass away, it says this is what happens to them afterwards. And you can put any number of different restrictions on how those assets are administered, such that you can put age restrictions, you can make restrictions that people have to take alcohol or drug tests, you can put restrictions that someone can't get it until they reach a certain education level, and any different number of things, whereas with a simple will, what that you're really kind of stuck with, a person attains the age of 18, they get the money. If you put in provisions other than that, for example, saying, well, someone has to be 25, then what you've done is you've created a will that needs to be probated and then turned into a trust. So there's a lot of different considerations in what people need or want to do down the line.
Well, okay. Now, what are my three basic options for getting started?
Well, the number one option that is out there is if you don't have anything in place, just continue that particular pattern. If you do nothing, then basically what then happens is if you pass away without a will or some other type of estate planning in place, then you pass away what's called intestate, and then the statutes and laws in whatever particular state you reside in then dictate where your assets go. Will generally go to your next of kin, but it would, you know, depending on who those people are, if you want it to go to them, and how you'd like it to go to them, you have really no say-so. Probate is necessary to be done in order to transfer those assets, and you just, if you decided, well, I really wouldn't like my third daughter to receive anything, if you don't have a will, chances are that person will receive something. Secondly, you can do a simple will, last will and testament, and that basically indicates this is where I would like these assets to go upon my passing. The general rule is that those assets go out in whatever percentages or whatever amounts that you dictate to a particular beneficiary at the age of 18. Generally speaking, though, giving anything that even resembles money to an 18-year-old is not the greatest of ideas. So if there are needs that someone has in order to not distribute those assets at the age of 18 or many other considerations, sometimes a living trust is appropriate. And again, that's sort of the one step up where you're transferring assets out of your name. Once those assets are out of your name, if you pass away, it really has no effect on the trust other than saying, upon this event, this person passing away, these assets are now supposed to be distributed or handled in this fashion. So a living trust gives you a lot more flexibility, a lot more ability to direct how things go, a lot more ability to be able to dictate how you wanted, what restrictions you'd want placed on it. It provides the potential for tax benefits. It provides the potential for holding assets back as well that would ultimately go to a beneficiary who, for example, may have some issues with creditors or taxes or things of that nature. There's mechanisms within a trust that would allow money to be held back and not given to that person or persons if in essence it's going to be intercepted and taken by a creditor away from them. So there's quite a different number of things that can be set up inside of a trust depending on a particular person's situation.
Okay. Now that we've kind of folks outlined what the different documents mean, let's discuss the living trust in detail. Living trusts are very popular estate planning documents. Even though they've been heavily marketed, there's still a lot of confusion about them. Now we're going to kind of take a time to say how a living trust actually works. And I want, Tom, with your help, to take the time to explain how they work and how they compare to a will. So the first question is, how is a living trust different from a will?
Well, one of the primary differences in a living trust, ultimately, I suppose a living trust and a will work the same after somebody's passing. They both administer your assets upon your passing, but one does so generally without the need to go to probate. But one of the primary differences with a living trust versus a will is that it also provides you what's called lifetime management of your assets. So you basically take your assets, put it into this entity that you and or your spouse control, and then in the event that you became incapacitated, it then manages your assets for you because it plugs someone else in there to run things for you. And it does so without court intervention, which is very key. Without that, if you, for example, just had the only document you had would be a will, you then have a potential that if you became incapacitated, then what's called a conservatorship would possibly have to be undertaken with you, and that is in essence a court-ordered, court-supervised financial power of attorney, and there's a lot of expense with doing that. There's attorneys that have to do it on behalf of someone that wants to get a conservatorship over you. The court then appoints a lawyer for you because you're deemed incapacitated, so someone has to speak for you. Then you have expenses with accountants for the court. You also have to file annual reports. It becomes quite burdensome to have to do that. And the other side of that is in a court proceeding what's known as a guardianship, which is a court-ordered, court-supervised medical power of attorney. And so it's those same types of hoops that have to be jumped through. But generally with a living trust, the idea is that you've pre-planned for these eventualities, and if they don't happen, then great. But if they do, you've got something in place that keeps you out of court both during your lifetime and hopefully keeps you out of court after your passing.
Okay. Well, now on a will, real specifically, there's, like all things in life, there's a good to a will and then there's a bad to a will. What would you say would be the good of a will, and what would you say is the bad of a will?
I guess the first thing, a will is generally speaking a simpler document than a living trust is. So in the world of lawyers, something simpler and something that doesn't take as long to do is cheaper. So it is less expensive on the front end to create than a trust is. It's just not as flexible and doesn't have as many things that you can do with a will. That's sort of the downside. It's also, once it does go through the probate process, if that is necessary, that becomes public record. So anything filed in a court of law is able to be looked at by anybody in the general public. The probate process itself, you have to go through. That can be expensive, can be time consuming. Depends on, you know, then it opens it up to a lot of different challenges. And then you have an issue of, if you, for example, were to give everything to your son John, and then John passes away, and inside of your will says, okay, if John passes away, I then want his share of my estate to go to his children, Bobby and Susie. But Bobby and Susie, at the time of your passing, are both minors. Then what has to happen at that point in time is then a what's often called a testamentary trust has to be created to hold that property for those minors until they reach the age of 18, and at which time it's generally speaking released to them without restriction. And so, again, an 18-year-old with money in his or her pocket can be a bad thing. So that is something that to consider. There's a lot of different contingencies that some folks don't sit down and think about, and also wouldn't necessarily know about. You know, I myself, as far as higher education went, I mean, I went to school, an undergraduate school, for 5 years, and then another 3 years in law school, and that was just to begin to start to understand all of this. So, you know, this is not something that, you know, you just one day you're enlightened and all of a sudden you know it.
Well, we kind of, I think, have established that for not everybody listening, but for most, we should at least look into a living trust. So, but there's got to be, like a will, a good and bad concerning a living trust. So would you go through that? What's the good about a trust and what's the bad about a trust?
Sure. Well, like we talked about earlier, the trust will generally assist people in avoiding probate. It does offer the lifetime management of your assets. It allows you to put a lot more restrictions on things if necessary. Will allow you to potentially protect the shares and the money that you wanted to go to a child or another beneficiary to be held back if necessary to avoid creditors just seizing it. It does generally help you avoid the probate process. That's one of the big draws for it. And it keeps, by definition, since if it does avoid the probate process, then it doesn't become public record. It keeps your assets private. It keeps your dealings private. And things are then transferred out in the fashion that you want them to be, and it doesn't become public for anybody to take a look at. They are certainly, because they are more complicated, they're more expensive on the front end than a will is. And with a trust as well, in order for a trust to control a particular asset, the trust has to own that asset. So you then have to go through the front load of work of transferring assets into a trust. Now that can sound daunting, but in reality, if you boil it down to its simplest idea, is you're really just doing a name change on your assets. So, for example, you would change the title on your house out of you and or your spouse's name into the name of the trust. Same with bank accounts, same with vehicle titles, RV titles, things of that nature, and then everything is then held by the trust. So there is some initial running around for you to do, and what that does, if anybody's ever been through the probate process and everything else, I mean, it's already a bad time for, you know, the family and loved ones to be dealing with, and then, you know, to be then burdened with having to figure out this whole probate process and wondering where to get money from and everything else in the beginning of the process. You know, the living trust is a very good gift to give to your family, because it takes that burden away. It makes it just a simple roadmap for them to follow.
Okay. And you touched on something that I wanted to ask you, and that, why does a living trust avoid probate?
Well, because the trust itself, what you're doing is you are really taking your assets out of your own name or names in the example of a married couple, and putting it into this fictitious entity. It's a fictitious thing, much like a limited liability company or corporation is. Now the because you do that, the trust itself, you've established it, you've built it, it just doesn't pass away when you do. It's much like how the example I give is with Ford Motor Company. You know, Henry Ford passed away, and and at least at certain points in history, that despite the best efforts of his children, it didn't you know, close. But it, you know, it kept moving along. Same idea with a trust. Trust in the state of Arizona, although they cannot last forever, recent changes to the laws here have allowed a trust in the state of Arizona to last up to 500 years. So that's generally speaking enough time to take care of distribution and paying bills and things of that nature. So, but basically the way that it avoids probate, long and short, is you've created this thing that has a 500-year life. So unless you live for 499 years, you know, then the trust has to shut down in 1 year. That's generally speaking not going to happen.
Sure, sure. Well, how do we actually transfer the assets into the living trust?
Like I said, it's generally speaking, it really is as simple as just changing the name on a title. So, for example, with real estate in the state of Arizona, what you would do is do a new deed that says I and/or my wife are transferring the interest in this piece of property to this living trust, and then that deed gets recorded with the county recorder's office in whatever county that property is located in. And then the new titled owner of the property is the trust. Same thing with bank accounts. What basically happens with a bank account is you would go to your Bank of America or Wells Fargo or what have you and indicate, we have a trust. I would like to transfer this account out. What then happens is the bank will make a copy of a document known as a certificate of trust, which is for the folks that are old enough to remember. It's the Reader's Digest version of your trust, very short and to the point. And that proves that you have a trust, then the trust becomes the owner of that bank account, and your checks don't change, though. You still get to have your name and or your wife's name on the checks. The only difference is when you get your bank statement, it's mailed to your trust, care of you, at your home address. So that way it doesn't necessarily advertise that you have a trust. So it does, again, keep those dealings private. As far as brokerage accounts, same idea as with bank accounts. You just do a name change on it. Other things like annuities and qualified plans, such as individual retirement accounts and things of that nature, those assets generally are going to have beneficiaries named. Usually it will be another person, or in some instances with IRAs, you can do what are called conduit provisions or what are known as IRA beneficiary trusts, where you would say, well, normally this would go and transfer to a child or children, and they would have complete ownership and be able to do what they wanted to with these assets. But in this instance, I'm making it go to my trust, which will then separately administer this qualified asset versus all of my other things, such as houses and regular bank accounts and things of that nature.
Now, is it easy once we've set this up, is it easy to change the trust?
It is very easy to change a trust. Actually, in Arizona, it's very easy to change. Even a will in Arizona, in particular, where the legal phrase for it is you are allowed to make testamentary instruments. They're actually allowed to make rather holographic amendments to testamentary instruments, and that's just a fancy way of saying you can make a written change to a trust or a will anytime you want, literally with a pen. I generally don't recommend that, in particular because you have sometimes in one section there is a corresponding section somewhere else later in the book, and if you change it in one, you don't change it in the other. They kind of butt heads with each other. But as far as the change itself goes, if it's a husband and wife, while both of them are alive and competent, they can make whatever changes they want. And generally speaking, the surviving spouse would be able to make changes as well, as would an individual person, any time that they wanted to, just about any provision that they wanted to.
Okay, and tell me now, we've done the trust and all the proper necessary documents. What happens when we do have a death? Is it more complicated, less complicated than a will? Walk us through what happens.
Yeah, it's generally less complicated now. With a husband and wife, it in most instances, what would happen is the surviving spouse then just receives all the assets in the trust, and it just continues moving along for his or her benefit during their lifetime. There may be some other instances where there's a little bit more administration if it's a larger estate or one that is set up to be divided. then there's a little bit more administration. But that's generally that what that consists of is just shuttling an asset or two into what's called a bypass trust and then obtaining a federal tax ID number. But generally speaking, like I said, in a lot of instances that's not necessary or desired. But when the surviving spouse was to pass, or just a person with a single trust was to pass, then the trust itself just acts as an instruction book, and it says, pay the debts, pay the expenses, distribute out, you know, gifts of cash to these particular charities, distribute keepsakes, as I have written down in my own hand in the back of this document, and then the balance of whatever's left in the box, as it were, divide in this fashion or hold in this fashion or whatever it says. But it really, it just, you know, another person gets plugged into the slot to steer the boat, as it were, and then the other, and then the instructions are there that says, this is what I want done, this is what you will do. And if the person, for example, doesn't want to do that, they don't have to, they can quit, and then the next person will be plugged into the slot. So it's generally, you know, the complication and the headaches, as if you will, are sort of front-loaded, and then it just becomes a, you know, look, this is what you need to do, follow these steps, and that's it.
Okay. And folks, we've given you an awful lot of information. I know you probably have some additional questions about a living trust, and we'd be happy to answer them. If you want to send me an email or just call the office, our office number is 480-969-5667. That's 480-969-5667. And for us folks in the north, Tom and I have a place up in Flagstaff. Here's the toll-free number, which is 877-525-7770. I'll repeat that. Toll-free, it's 877-525-7770. Now, before we end the program, I want to share with you some useful advice to consider before you hire a professional to help you. Almost any attorney can write a will, but a living trust is different. The estate planner should assist you by writing the documents, helping explain how to fund the estate, and most importantly, teaching you how to manage the trust. Too often, I've seen people invest good money to write a trust where the assets were not properly funded into the trust, and that leaves you with nothing more than an expensive will. Folks, I don't want that to happen to you. You want to ensure that the right professional is there, and I want to teach you about that now. So this next section, section 3, is how to find the right professional help. Here's a few guidelines you can use to help you pick the right professional. I would suggest you asking them these 6 important questions. Number 1, how many years have they been performing estate planning work? If you desire to have a living trust created, ask the attorney how many trusts they've actually prepared. Number 2, if you have a large estate, over $5 million, does the attorney have experience with tax planning, because that certainly gets involved, or have associates that he or she can help you with, assist you with more strategic planning issues? We see this a lot. Number 3, how many estates has the attorney actually settled? This is very important. An estate planner who has seen his or her documents administered and settled is one who understands the entire process and can advise you on issues that may arise after your death. Number 4, how much do they charge for the preparation of your will, trust, or both? If the professional charges by the hour, ask them what type of information they would need from you to receive a ballpark estimate. Number 5, how long will it take to prepare your estate planning documents? This is especially important if time is of the essence. And number 6, can you come in for a free consultation? Some planners offer a free 30-minute to an hour consultation. Even if they charge a small fee, an initial consultation may be really a good idea, because your dealings, you have to be able to relate to them. They have to understand what you want. When you're explaining to put something down, they have to physically and mentally put that into the trust document, and so it plays out the way you want. Well, folks, in conclusion, I hope this program has been helpful for you and gets you started in the right direction. I understand that you probably have additional questions, and that's why I'd like to extend an invitation to just give me a call. If you'd like to ask a follow-up question, just simply email me. My email is Jeff, J-E-F-F, at azestateplan.com. That's Jeff at azestate, E-S-T-A-T-E, plan.com. Or just call the office at 480-969-5667. That's 480-969-5667. And we'd be glad and happy to help with you. I want to thank our expert guest today, Attorney Thomas Lavelle. Tom, thank you so much for being with us today. We've worked together for, well, I think it's more than 5 years now, and I know we've helped thousands of families create a solid estate plan. Again, if you'd like to see if we'd be a good match to help you protect your family and your estate, I welcome you to call or email me, and we'll be happy to answer your questions. Again, I want to thank you for downloading this program, and folks, have a nice day. And Tom, once again, thank you very much for being our expert.
You bet, anytime. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. Bye-bye for now, folks.